You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get a preview of a unique musical convention happening this week in Wisconsin. First, between now and the August 14th primary, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and on the morning show. You can find all of these interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today, we talk to Kathy Myers. She's a Janesville school board member and a longtime teacher. She's a Democrat running for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives in Wisconsin's first congressional district, which includes Janesville. Kathy Myers, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
We'll start us off with your basic pitch. If you had 30 seconds to talk to a voter, what would you tell them?
Well, I would tell them that I'm running for Congress because I think that health care is a human right, and I support Medicare for all. I also, as a teacher and as a member of the Janesville School Board, believe that we need to do everything we can to protect public education, especially from the likes of Betsy DeVos and her voucher program. And I also think, related to that, that common sense gun reform must be on the table. As a teacher, I am really concerned about the dominance and the threat to our students of gun violence.
You mentioned your career as a teacher. What about your background there and as a school board member prepares you to be a representative in Congress?
Well, as a school board member, I have examined budgets, I've built coalitions, and I've brought around reforms that were unheard of because of my work on the school board, and because I also helped other people who cared about public education to get elected. We've been able to protect benefits for teachers in the Janesville school system, increase salaries, and bring back Just Cause. And most importantly, we stopped the tide of teachers leaving the district. They were leaving in droves right after Act 10. And so we have stabilized the Janesville district.
You started off this campaign as a challenge to House Speaker Paul Ryan, who's represented that district for nearly 20 years. He's out of the race now, but looking at the person you're looking to take over for, how do you think Ryan has served the district?
Well, I don't think that Ryan has done a good job serving the district, obviously. If there's one common thread that I've heard from people as I've talked to thousands of people actually throughout the district, is that they don't feel as though they were served. They felt as though they were ignored. And I want to bring back honest-to-goodness representation to the district, where I will be present and available throughout the district on a regular basis, bringing their concerns to Washington.
What are some of the unique issues in Wisconsin's first congressional district that you think maybe don't get enough attention in Congress?
Well, I think that some of the unique issues would be the loss of our manufacturing base that we had. We used to have a very strong manufacturing base in this district with Janesville and Kenosha and parts in between, of course. And we haven't done a good job of restoring those jobs that were lost with the close of GM and, Chrysler. And I believe that the key to restoring our manufacturing is to tie us to what I think is the fastest growing sector, which is the energy sector, and specifically renewable energy and green energy, clean energy jobs. And I think that I know that we would be able to start, with revamping our manufacturing, and also, improve the number of jobs through installation and service, and also revamp our tech programs as we build coalitions between this new industry and education.
Talking to Kathy Myers, Democrat running in the primary race for the U.S. House of Representatives in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, the seat currently held by Paul Ryan, House Speaker. Kathy Myers, let's talk about immigration, a big issue, a big ongoing issue in Congress. What are your views on immigration?
Well, I believe that the Dreamers need a path to citizenship. We just had a situation here in Racine just a week or so ago where a young man who's been here for over 20 years was swept up by ICE And, you know, as he was leaving his mother's home, this is not a criminal. This is a person who is our neighbor. He's a contributing member to our community. And so we need to make sure that we have a path to citizenship for them and for their parents who have been here for a very long time. I think that the separation of families at the border was unconscionable. It was cruel, and it was a choice, and it was things that didn't have to happen. We needed to send federal judges down there, immigration judges down there, to help process those claims and to let the system work the way that it's supposed to work. I also believe that we need to take ICE, which is, I think, has become a rogue agency, as demonstrated by the arrest of that young man in Racine last week. And we need to put it back under the Justice Department, which is where it used to be. I think it needs a lot of oversight, and it needs to follow the rule of law. And I think that the Justice Department is the appropriate place to put that service.
Tax reform was a big issue for Speaker Ryan. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 passed in the Congress. The president signed it into law. What are your views on that act? What would you change about the tax system?
Well, I thought that the tax system and the tax reform bill that Speaker Ryan advocated and got passed through was horrible. It was billions and billions of dollars of giveaway to the people at the very top. It's going to add to our deficit and increase our what we owe future generations. I believe that, you know, I think that people at the very top need to pay their fair share. And, you know, what it does, of course, is it provides the Republicans with the opportunity to turn their sights on Medicare and Social Security and to treat those like there's something that we can't afford. And so because they have blown up the deficit so much, then they can use this as a justification to say that they need to take away the social safety net from the people who need it most, while they have given so many benefits to people at the very top. And so I am really concerned about attempts to do that.
You mentioned education earlier. To a large extent, that's a state issue, but there is a federal element. What would you look for in Congress on education?
Well, we need to stop the expansion, first of all, of the voucher program as proposed by Betsy DeVos. The voucher program takes local money out of local communities and sends it elsewhere. It's your tax dollars being sent out of your area and to places and to people that are not accountable to you and to your tax dollars. And it is also an attempt to starve out public education and turn education into something that is only for the elite. And so that would be one of the first things that I do. I also think that we need, and I think I mentioned this before, we need a lot of partnerships between schools, high schools, and tech colleges and community colleges. We need to provide free technical school and community college and public university. We need to make sure that students with a student loan debt can refinance and rework that student loan debt and discharge it in bankruptcy if they have to. But, you know, we could also prevent them from having so much debt by offering free public college and also by increasing things like Pell Grants and truly investing in education. I also think that we need to have free universal pre-K in this country. The investment that we make there will save us a lot of money and also really improve the chances for students, especially low-income students, to thrive.
And briefly, as we wrap up, for primary voters in particular, why you to represent Democrats in this race?
Because this is the best opportunity we've had to take back this seat in 20 years. and we need someone coming out of the primary, the strongest candidate, someone who knows what it means to run and to win and to serve, and that's me. My primary opponent has never won an election before, and he has never served. He's never had to get reelected. I want to bring service back to this district, and I've done it in my service in Janesville as well. And honestly, my primary opponent also carries a lot of problems, things from his past that will be exploited by the Republicans. And so that's not having the strongest candidate coming out of the primary.
Kathy Myers, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kathy Myers is running as a Democrat for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, which includes Janesville. We talked to her primary opponent yesterday, Randy Bryce. Businessman Paul Nalen, a Republican candidate in that race, will join us this time tomorrow. Between now and the August 14th primary, candidates who are running in contested primaries have the opportunity to join us for interviews on Central Time in the Morning Show. Find all these interviews at wisconsinvote.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the flutes of the world are converging on Wisconsin. This week, we'll preview the World Flute Society Convention. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a profile of a Wisconsin musician who plays the flute.
The flute is one of the oldest instruments in the world, after the human voice. Almost every culture has their version of one, and chances are, flutist Peter Phippen wants to play it. The Eau Claire musician has spent the last 3 decades playing and studying flutes from around the world, but Phippen didn't discover the instrument until later in life.
Well, we'd go on tour in the rock band. I was a touring bassist. Different city every night, and after a 60 or 90 day tour, I promised my wife I'd buy her something after a tour, and she wanted a sofa, and she dragged me all over Eau Claire looking at sofas, and the last place we ended up was a World Bazaar gift shop at the mall. It's no longer there, and they had a basket of bamboo penny whistles from India. Now, I'm not lying, I failed the recorder in 5th grade. I could not play it. But I picked up one of these 25-cent bamboo penny whistles from India, and the thing just started playing by itself. I thought this is pretty interesting, so I bought it. There's vast amounts of flutes in the world, and a lot of them have different embouchures. A lot of them have different tunings. You know, some have no holes. You know, harmonic overtone flute, great example. And that's found in Norway, in Africa, in Eastern Europe. The Edo period shakuhachi is one of my favorite instruments to play. And you can hear that on my song. It's not my song. It's a song that came through me in the studio, Lasco. To me, that song has a darker edge. It's not in me, it's in the universe. I believe that music is already there, floating around the world. It's in the ethers. And what I try to do as a spiritual flute player is to tap into that. And if you can tap into that and ride it, it's a bucking bronco. But if you can hang on, then some beautiful things happen. Magic happens. I've always been an improvisationalist, and that's all I wanted to do. There's a few songs on my albums that are not improvisations, very few. But most everything I've recorded is improvised in the studio. I work with a flute for a long time. I have it all dialed in. Then I'll go into the studio. I have a handful of musicians that know how to do this with me. And I'll just look at them and go, C sharp minor. Go. And that's how the music happens. I've seen, you know, classically trained flutists and Irish flutists who have great technique and great skill, and they can play the same thing over and over at amazing rates of speed. That's not what I do. I go completely the other direction. I try to play long and slow, and sometimes if a fast passage arises, it's good to have some technique because if the music calls for a fast passage or the improvisation, then I'm able to pull it off. But I never go for that. I never go for that at all.
Peter Phippen is a flutist based in Eau Claire. He'll be playing with many other musicians this week at the World Flute Society Convention at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more information at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
That World Flute Society convention is kicking off today, as we just heard, in Eau Claire. Kathleen Joyce Grendel is Executive Director of the World Flute Society. She joins us now to tell us more about the event. Kathleen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, today is day one of the Flute Society's annual convention. Tell us a little bit about the event.
Actually, we come to Eau Claire every other year, and we are hosted by the music department here at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. And basically, we come and they let us have, you know, the run of the school and fulfill our needs. And we bring in a bunch of flutists in different genres. This time around, we have a Bonsri player, a Celtic group. We have Brian Ritchie playing shakuhachi with Michael Batine playing gongs. Ron Korb is from Canada. He's a world flutist. We have Native American flute players. We have Indian Carnatic musician, and a bunch of world flute players. So it's a great variety.
I think when people think flute, at least in this country, they probably picture the silver flute that we might have seen in band class. It seems like it really is a universal instrument. So many different cultures had their own permutation of the flute.
Yes, this is true. And we are representing many of those at the convention.
Yeah, you were giving a taste of the different styles of music. You really have performers, I was looking through the list, almost from all over the world.
Right. We try to bring in as many diverse musicians as possible. And we have a pretty good lineup this time for the evening concerts.
Can you talk about your own personal history with the instrument?
Well, I received my Doctor of Musical Arts degree from the University of Arizona in silver flute. And instead of my thesis or my dissertation being in something related to the silver flute, I chose to write a dissertation on the Native American flute in the Southwest. And it kind of kicked off from there. And I was asked to be the executive director of the International Native American Flute Association. And I did that for 17 years. And then I morphed it into the World Flute Society to make it more inclusive of other traditions, give us a wider audience.
And as instruments go, I've played a little flute coming from the saxophone side, and we heard in that Wisconsin Life piece, are flutes fairly easy for people to come in and pick up, or does it really depend on what kind of flute you're talking about?
It depends on the flute type. The Native American flute is really accessible to almost anyone. Some people read music playing it, but the majority of people just improvise in what we call play from the heart. It's a very easy instrument to pick up. Some of the other instruments are a little more difficult because they're transverse flutes like the silver flute and require a specific embouchure. And sometimes that's difficult for folks to pick up quickly.
Do you feel, having this World Flute Society, that there is a kinship of flutists from different places, different backgrounds?
Oh, definitely. It's really interesting when you bring this variety of people together. You know, sometimes they end up, you know, playing on each other's sets, or they contact each other later on, and they do recording projects together. So it's like a... It grows relationships between performers as well as participants who come and listen.
Yeah, is there an opportunity for people, you know, there are the formal performances, but are there chances for people to just to get together and jam and see how different kinds of flutes sound together?
Yes, we have a vendor area in the lobby of Haas Fine Arts Center where many people are selling world flutes, Native American flutes, other drums. We have a didgeridoo player here. And, you know, people will go to various vendors and try the flutes, and sometimes they end up jamming together.
And can the public come and check out the performances and talks and things like that?
The workshops during the day require registration, but the evening concerts are open to the public, and the shows start at 7 p.m., and there's three or four performers each night. And, you know, they can come to the vendor area for free. It's open to the public. They just want to come and check out something.
Obviously, you have a love for the flute. Would you want to talk to people young and old and encourage them not just to listen, but to give it a try?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The more people that know about the world flutes, the better. It's such an amazing experience.
Now, you've played a lot of different kinds of flutes, I imagine. Are there ones out there around the world that you haven't yet played that you're thinking, oh, maybe this year somebody will show up with one and I can give it a try?
No, I've played a lot of flutes. some flutes are easier to play than others. There's a type of flute that's a rim-blown flute that really is, it's almost like just a hollow stick with a little notch in the end. Peter Fippen excels at those, but that gives me a little trouble occasionally.
And are you going to get a chance to perform, or are you going to be too busy organizing this whole thing?
This time around, I was asked to play with a Native American flute player and a percussionist on one of the concerts. So I will be playing silver flute this year.
All right, Kathleen, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with the event.
Okay, thank you.
Kathleen Joyce Grendel is Executive Director of the World Flute Society. As we heard, their convention is taking place starting today at UW-Eau Claire. Now, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews here on Central Time and on The Morning Show. You'll be able to find all of those interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today, we continue our interviews with candidates for governor. There's a contested primary for both Republicans and Democrats. Today, we talked to political activist Mike McCabe, who's running in the Democratic primary. Mike McCabe, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're starting everybody off with their elevator pitch. You have the length of an elevator ride to tell someone why you're running for governor of Wisconsin. What do you tell them?
I'm running because we've got a government that works exceptionally well for a wealthy and well-connected few at the very top, but has left an awful lot of people behind. And, you know, I've traveled 90,000 miles now during this campaign all across Wisconsin, and I find an awful lot of forgotten people living in forgotten places, some in the inner city, some way out in the country like where I'm from, but they don't feel like their voices are being heard and their interests are certainly not being represented. And I think that has a lot to do with the influence of big money in politics. And, of course, my life's work has been about exposing the cronyism and corruption and what amounts to legal bribery that has taken root in our political system. We've got to uproot it. That has been the work I've done for much of my adult life. I take that mission into the governor's race and hopefully into the governor's office itself.
Now, how can you talk more about your experience with the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and your group Blue Jean Nation and how that prepares you to be governor?
Yeah, you know, I started a group called the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and led it as its director for 15 years. And that group was devoted first and foremost to following the money and helping to expose the transactions between wealthy donors and elected officials and then connect the dots between those transactions and decisions that government makes. And one of the things I've learned after all those years of following the money is that one half of 1% of the American population supplies more than 2/3 of all the political money. And what those wealthy donors want our government to do is really different than what the rest of the population wants our government to do. And they get their way on so many issues that affect every issue that we care about. And that's what's got to change. We've got to challenge and overcome that money power, and I think we do it with people power, with grassroots organization. So that's the kind of campaign that I was committed to running from the start, was one that was truly grassroots and truly people powered in nature and relied on the volunteer energy of thousands of people across the state, rather than simply chasing fat cat donors from coast to coast and trying to raise the most money.
when you were debating whether to run for governor, you weighed running as possibly an independent or a Democrat at the UW-Milwaukee-sponsored debate last month. You wouldn't pledge to support whoever the Democratic winner is coming out of the primary if it isn't you. So for Democrats looking to vote in a Democratic primary, does that give them pause? Do you worry that they might be dissuaded from supporting you for those reasons?
Well, I haven't belonged to a political party of any kind over the course of my life, and I did work as an independent watchdog that put me in a position of calling out Democrats and Republicans when I saw wrongdoing or unethical behavior, and I make no apologies for that work. I'm proud of it. And now that I'm running for governor, for me, it's pretty simple. I just think it's a mistake to make party loyalty pledges. To say that whoever the nominee is, just because they've got a D behind their name, that's the person you'll support, I think is immensely disrespectful to the voters out there. What it says to the voters is that party is more important than anything. Party comes before the people. Party comes before country. And that's just a horrible message to send to the voters of this state. They're fed up with the cancerous partisanship and the fact that Democrats and Republicans can't talk to each other, much less work things out with each other. And when they hear politicians say that party comes before everything, that's a huge turnoff. And what I can tell you is I won't vote for Scott Walker. That's the one thing that's sure. We need a new governor, and I'm committed to getting Wisconsin a new governor. So somebody with my values and my desire to see Wisconsin have a new direction, I can't vote for Scott Walker. But I just think it's a mistake to make a party loyalty pledge and say it doesn't matter who the person is as long as they've got a D behind the name.
Talking to Mike McCabe about his campaign in the Democratic primary for governor. Governor Walker is making the case that the state doesn't need a change of governor. Things are working. Unemployment is low. Businesses are having a hard time finding people to fill jobs. So things are going well. Why should voters want to change?
Yeah, he talks a lot about the low unemployment rate. And I would say, hey, look, people can find work out there. But I saw a recent report that said if you're a minimum wage worker, you need 3 jobs to afford housing in the state. And there's so many people out there who are working 2 or 3 jobs and they can't keep their heads above water. Wisconsin so far in the 21st century has seen its middle class shrink more than any state in America. And we now have levels of economic inequality in our state not seen since the Great Depression. And we're dead last in the nation in new business startups for the last 3 straight years. So, yeah, people can find work out there. In fact, they've often collected 2 or 3 jobs, but they still can't keep themselves in the middle class. That's what's got to change. We've got to, instead of feeding the rich, instead of showering tax breaks and state subsidies on a few at the very top and hope that they work magic for the rest of us, we've got to use our state's resources to empower regular working people from the ground up. And that means a living wage for every worker, health care for all, debt-free education for our young people, bring high-speed internet everywhere to every part of this state. Those are the tools that regular people need to be able to do more for themselves and for each other.
Yeah, what would your top priorities be if you were elected governor on day one, aimed at boosting wages in Wisconsin?
I am committed to seeing a substantial increase in the minimum wage. Up to $15 an hour phased in over 5 years, and then adjust that wage for inflation going forward after that. Make it a true living wage. And then the other thing is I think we got to get rid of the wage suppression policies that have been put in place. And one of them, for example, is often called right to work. And I'm sorry, I refuse to call it right to work. Workers had the right to work before. What this is a wage suppression policy. This is about keeping wages low. And to me, that's a killer for our economy. Low wages are a killer for the economy. They suppress demand and they inhibit sales. The way to create a sturdy economy is to put more money in the pockets of regular working people, because when they get more money in their pockets, they don't do what a lot of rich people do. They don't stash it in a tax haven in Bermuda or the Cayman Islands. They don't just pad their net worth with it. They don't take it out of circulation. They spend it. And when they spend it, somebody's got to sell what they want to buy. And that stimulates business. That creates economic prosperity.
The argument from business groups is, hey, if you raise the minimum wage, you restore union rules, that increases the cost for us to do business. That's going to make us less likely to hire people. We're going to hire fewer people.
Now, and that's never happened over the course of our country's history for as long as we've had a minimum wage. The federal minimum wage has been raised more than 20 times. And never once during all those years when the minimum wage was increased did the number of jobs decline or disappear. Never once did the economy shrink. The economy grew through more than 20 increases in the minimum wage, and employment, overall numbers of jobs, grew over the course of more than 20 increases in the minimum wage. So despite that propaganda, the reality paints a very different picture. And again, it's about making an about face, a total 180-degree turn in the way we think about building a sturdy economy. We can either feed the rich, we can depend on trickle-down economics, or we can embrace what I like to call geyser economics. I just think that you got to accept that economic prosperity doesn't trickle down. It gushes up. And we've got to put more money in the pockets of regular working people. We've got to empower them with other investments like healthcare for all and education opportunity that they can get debt free without we ought to have a state where you can work your way through school and come out without being buried under a mountain of debt, and bring high speed internet to every nook and cranny of the state. Do those things and rebuild our infrastructure. We can have a much healthier economy. We don't have to be leading the nation in shrinkage of the middle class.
Staying with the economy for a moment, we've got this Foxconn deal. Ground has been broken. A state investment here. What's your view on that? What would you do as governor?
I think it's an example of the very kind of approach that has failed us for decades and will continue to fail us. I just don't think crony capitalism and corporate welfare is the way to build a sturdy economy. And it's another example of showering tax breaks and state subsidies on a few. There's the old saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket. And here Wisconsin is putting all of its eggs, $4.5 billion worth of eggs, in one basket, with the hope that this one company that subsidizing the global expansion of a Taiwanese conglomerate is going to work magic for Wisconsin. It's a strategy that has failed us for years. I think it'll keep right on failing us. I think we have to do that about face. We have to change our philosophy of economic development. You take the state of Minnesota. Minnesota raised taxes on the rich, increased spending for education, and raised wages by increasing the minimum wage. We did the opposite in Wisconsin. Cut taxes for the rich, cut education spending, kept wages as low as federal law allows. Minnesota surged ahead of Wisconsin by just about every measure of economic activity.
But as governor, do you cancel the Foxconn deal or try to?
I would love to get Wisconsin taxpayers off the hook for $4.5 billion worth of corporate welfare payments, and I don't think this is the right approach, the right strategy, and I would absolutely insist on renegotiation of terms. We've got a signed agreement, and I think it's an overpromise to simply say that Wisconsin can cancel that contract without being then sued for breach of contract. If somebody's going to breach this contract, it should be Foxconn, and it should be the state of Wisconsin on behalf of our taxpayers who say you've breached the contract and we're going to cancel it. But there's going to be opportunities to continue to look at this over the course of years.
Talking to political activist Mike McCabe right now. He's a Democratic candidate in the primary race for governor, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What question do you have for the candidate? Do you want to know where he stands on a particular issue? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Mike McCabe is with us. We're talking about his campaign in the Democratic primary for governor of Wisconsin, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for Mike McCabe? What issues do you want him to weigh in on? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. To your calls, Brad is with us in Milwaukee. Brad, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Brad?
Okay. When did companies and politics in general just lose sight of the fact that it's the middle class and below that who actually pay for these companies to have these products? I mean, if I'm rich and I've already got $30 million in the bank account, but your government over here is going to give me a tax break of another million, I'm not going to spend that million. I'm not going to put it into the economy. I'm not going to go to Walmart. I'm not going to go to Menards. I'm not going to go to local mom and pop shops. So when did that idea change that the middle class is what actually keeps America going and businesses going, and instead it became, you know what, rich people need more?
Brad, gotcha. Mike?
Yeah, Henry Ford was one of the most legendary businessmen in American history, and he famously said, I want to pay workers enough so that they can afford to buy a Ford. He understood that he depended on regular working people to be able to buy his cars. If he was going to sell many cars, he couldn't just sell them to his rich friends. He needed a middle class that could support that business. That was an enlightened attitude about the connection between a company and the community that has been weakened and in some extent is disappearing from the landscape. That has to be brought back. We've got to have a middle class if we're going to have a healthy economy.
Back to your calls. Mary is on the line in Brookfield. Mary, hi.
Hi, and hi to Mike McCabe. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Hi. Mike, my question is this. All of the Democratic challengers who were in the race up to whatever point all indicated that they would, you know, were somewhat profound about, you know, we're going to reverse Act 10. We're going to get rid of Act 10. And I don't know that that's so easily done considering the many layers to Act 10. Could you maybe help me out with that?
Well, Act 10, of course, took away public sector employees' collective bargaining rights, their ability to unionize and bargain as a group with government employers. And that law was, Act 10 was a law that was made. It can be unmade. It can be repealed. I actually think it's not a sustainable policy for Wisconsin because you take schools, for example, because of Act 10, I think it's a big factor. We've now got more and more veteran teachers fleeing the profession. They are demoralized. They're discouraged. They feel devalued, and they are leaving the profession early, and yet we've got fewer and fewer young people wanting to enter the teaching profession by going into teacher training. And that's a recipe for disaster over the long haul. And we've got small rural school systems out there that I've talked to that have job openings and no applicants. Now, how are you going to run a school system if you've got job openings and nobody applying for those jobs? And so that's a serious problem that we've got to address. I do favor repealing Act 10, but what I am committed to is doing it as part of a package that helps all working people in every sector of the economy. We can't simply single out one group of workers and say we're going to help them and then have other groups of working people resent those few who get some help. We've got to do this in a way that helps all working people in every sector of the economy so that working people can't be pitted against each other and divided and conquered.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Mark on the line in Richland Center. Mark, hello.
Hi, Mike. This whole budget process that we're in, the largest or one of the largest expenses in our budget is debt service because we borrow from a bank that we don't own. Could you speak to the idea that we, the people, should own the bank so that when we borrow money, we borrow from ourselves, and then we pay ourselves back and put that interest right back into our own budget like they do in South Dakota, or North Dakota, rather?
A public-owned state bank, I guess he's talking about.
Yeah, and there it is North Dakota. There is a State Bank of North Dakota, and actually long before I ever became a candidate for governor, I did a lot of writing and speaking about how a state bank like the State Bank of North Dakota would make a lot of sense for Wisconsin to keep our capital in our state and to keep our capital working for people in Wisconsin. It's an idea that should be explored by our state. But when you talk about state transportation policy is a great example of where we've based our transportation policy on the worst two options imaginable: neglect of basic upkeep to the point where we now have some of the worst roads in the country, and then heavy reliance on borrowing to the extent that we are spending on roads. And that's just flat out irresponsible. 24 cents out of every dollar that we spend, that we pay in gas tax now, doesn't go to pave anything. It goes for debt repayment. So we're putting all this on a credit card rather than paying as we pave, and that's got to change. But, you know, I think the debate over a state bank like North Dakota has, they've used it, for example, for student debt refinancing, to have capital in their state that can be used to help students get out from underneath the burden of crushing student debt. We don't have such an approach here in Wisconsin. And so we've got the average student coming out with $30,000 in debt. I met a young woman not too long ago who had $150,000 in accumulated student debt. When is she ever going to put a down payment on a home? When is she going to be able to buy a car? And what does that do to the home builders and the realtors and the automakers and the car dealers when an entire generation isn't able to participate in the economy that way and make those purchases? It hurts our whole economy. And North Dakota has used its state bank to be able to enable people to do student debt refinancing and get out from underneath that crushing debt. So it's a model that I think we ought to look at in Wisconsin.
Talking to Mike McCabe about his campaign in the Democratic primary for governor. Back to your calls. Eloise is on the line in Wautoma. Eloise, hi.
Hi. I haven't heard any of our Democrats running for governor talk about automatic weapon sales in Wisconsin and gun control here. I know we haven't had any schools shot up, but thank God for that.
Eloise asking about guns and gun control issues, Mike.
Yeah, I grew up on a farm, and that means I came from hunting country, and I've hunted myself. But I'll tell you, you don't need a bump stock to turn a regular gun into a machine gun to go hunting. You don't need a 30-round clip. You don't need 30-round magazine to go hunting. You get the one shot at the deer, you miss, the deer is gone. You don't need 30 shots. So I've actually come out in favor of 16 different steps. Comprehensive criminal background checks and restore the 48-hour waiting period for gun purchases. I do support banning military assault weapon sales. Ban bump stocks. You don't need machine gun to go hunting. None of the steps I've taken, 16 different steps to address gun violence and make schools and communities safer and save lives, would require us to repeal the Second Amendment or stop people from hunting or stop law-abiding people from owning guns. But it would address the underlying problems that lead to these mass eruptions of violence. And we can take these steps, but it does require being willing and able to stand up to the gun manufacturing lobby, the NRA. And they oppose every one of these 16 steps that I've come out in favor of. So I tell you, we're not going to get anything more than thoughts and prayers after each new mass shooting as long as elected officials are paid to take no other action. Standing up to that very powerful lobby is central to being able to get to the point where some common sense decisions can be made that respects hunting and respects the Second Amendment, but deals with these underlying causes of mass shootings.
Thanks for the call. Time for, I think, one more caller. Dayton is on the line in La Crosse. Dayton, hello.
Hi. I work in the trades, and I went to a trade school here in La Crosse. I just wanted to hear Mr. McCabe's thoughts on promoting the trades and promoting trade schools in Wisconsin.
All for it, and I think that, you know, a four-year university is not for everybody. I think for some people, an apprentice program or a two-year program that gets them the skills that they need to go out in the workplace is what they need. We need to invest in education for all of that. But I'll tell you this. For those who are trying to turn four-year universities into glorified trade schools by eliminating the arts and humanities, I think that's a mistake too. I think our best protection from employment being automated out of existence by robots and by driverless vehicles that are coming is the ability to think critically and creatively and strategically, to be able to think. And that is something that is very much nurtured by arts and humanities education. So I think there's an important place for that too. So as much as I'm devoted to creating good job training opportunities, debt-free job training for everyone so that they get the skills they need to be employable, as committed as I am to that and the two-year vocational technical colleges and making those investments, I'm equally committed to preserving arts and humanities education in those four-year universities.
We'll leave it there for now. Mike McCabe, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Mike McCabe is running for governor in the Democratic primary. Businessman Robert Meyer, who's running as a Republican challenging Governor Walker in the primary, will join us at this time tomorrow. Profiles of all of the Democratic and Republican candidates for governor can be found at WPR.org/governor. And between now and the August 14th primary, we'll be talking to more candidates and more of those coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.